This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Ralph Fiennes, and I'm having an affair with the River Cafe.
I can honestly not remember where or when I met Ralph Fiennes. It is often said that the test of a true friendship is that after being apart for a long time, you're able to pick up just where you left off. Ralph and I recorded this podcast a while ago, and since then, we've been apart too much for my liking. He in Rome, filming Conclave, in New York, in David Hare's Straight Line Crazy, in Greece, The Return, and in his beloved Suffolk, creating a new home with a beautiful kitchen. Is that okay to say that? It's a beautiful kitchen.
Yeah, it's a good kitchen.
Okay. The beautiful kitchen. But right now, we are on Ruthie's Table 4 to talk about the work he's doing, what he's been cooking, and then we will have dinner at the River Cafe. And like the loving, close friends we are, pick up just where we left off.
Chocolate nemesis. 10 eggs. 575 grams of caster sugar. 675 grams of best quality dark chocolate. 450 grams of unsalted butter. Softened. Preheat the oven to 130 degrees centigrade. Whisk the eggs with a third of the sugar with an electric mixer until the volume quadruples. This will take at least 10 minutes. Meanwhile, melt the chocolate and butter together in a heat-proof bowl set over a pan of barely simmering water. Remove from the heat. Heat the remaining sugar with 250 milliliters of water in a small saucepan until the sugar has dissolved to a syrup, stirring occasionally. Gently pour into the melted chocolate, stirring. Slowly add the warm chocolate and syrup mixture to the eggs. Increase the speed and continue beating until completely combined. The mixture will lose volume. Pour into the prepared cake tin and put into a deep baking tray on top of a tea towel to prevent the cake tin from moving. Fill the baking tray with hot water so that it comes at least two-thirds up the sides of the cake tin. Bake for 1.5 to 2 hours or until set. Test by placing the flat of your hand gently on the surface of the cake.
Well, I was going to ask you why you chose Nemesis, but when you said that you were having an affair with a restaurant, it all made sense because I was thinking if you see food as a seduction, you know, and whether we think that if you were having an affair with a restaurant, you were having an affair with a woman, would that be part of the seduction?
Well, there's always a sensual connection with food. Food is sensuality. And as I've grown older, or the last few years especially, I have found myself cooking more and more and loving cooking and loving the preparation. That connection to food and cooking has grown.
Oh, hi, this is Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sean, just the
highest
possible chef here. We're getting Sean to come and just talk about the Nemesis.
Okay.
Just for a minute. Will you talk about the Nemesis?
Of course.
Because you have made it for how many years, Pierre?
25 years, maybe, yeah. I was trying to work out while you were reading the recipe how many Nemesis we might have sold. Well, how many are we selling a year?
I think we do 10,000 a year.
Ooh.
So times 30 would be, is that 300,000 or is it 30?
Yeah. Let's say 500,000.
Yeah, maybe.
But you do make it sound quite relaxing when you're reading it, but when you're making... Yeah. It's also the chocolate cake that eludes most people. It's probably one of the most difficult chocolate cakes to get perfect.
And why is that, do you think? What's the secret, the knack?
Well, it used to be a real secret, didn't it, Ruthie, that no one could ever make it. And then when we did the River Cafe 30 book, we gave a more real recipe of how to do it.
Was it deliberate withholding of information?
No, I say people say there are quite a few recipes in the blue book that people say it just doesn't work, and I say, give me a break. It was our first cookbook, yeah. You know, like that you. But it is a hard one to make, and I think the tin was very big, and Julian Barnes famously wrote a piece about the fact that there was a time in the 90s when you went to anybody's home for dinner and you'd see this kind of splodge of chocolate. It was just the splodge of chocolate. That was the attempt to make the nemesis. But then when we... Actually, I think Easy has an easy nemesis, doesn't it, too?
There's one tried and tested technique to reduce percentage of failure, I'd say, which is to make sure that you never take it out of the tin until it's totally cold.
Okay.
And if it's a little tiny bit warm, like lukewarm...
It'll just... Splodge.
Splodge, yeah. You'd have to pipe it into
splodge.
A bowl. Yeah. And
chocolate
that's
splodge.
Where you get tins.
That's a really good hint, isn't it? That's a good
yeah,
tip.
That's our probably top tip. Mm. And actually the amount...
Is that because the chocolate itself has to cool and... Is it the chocolate
I
and the butter?
So.
Just,
I think
it's just cooling and
yeah,
hardening.
Yeah, and if you really have made a mistake, you probably could just put it in the fridge and it would set. Mm-hmm. But that's a sort of off the record.
Yeah, that is
don't try that.
You looked a bit panicked because you gave that away.
Oops.
But the other thing about the nemesis is that it has no flour, as you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Really, it is like making a souffle because you beat the eggs so much, don't you? And then
it's a workout.
It's a workout.
Because it has no flour, it appeals to the gluten-free, and so therefore it's almost a health food in itself, a healthy cake.
Except for the sugar, the eggs, and the butter.
Don't ask. We have worked out the calorific value of a one slice, but we can't divulge that because we'll never sell another slice.
Was it 1,000 calories?
It was quite a lot. It was like a daily, half a day's.
Yeah, what's your
food? But just have a slither.
Yeah.
It is so good. And and then obviously the quality of the chocolate that you
So what chocolate?
In.
Can you reveal the brand or the name of the chocolate?
We shop around for chocolate. Okay. We would probably buy chocolate that's seasonal,
right,
and going
okay.
around the world with the season of
okay.
chocolate making.
Okay,
we've tried different chocolates and different. Some of them.
Remember, we had that nemesis tasting. Do you remember?
That was hardcore.
It was really hardcore.
Yeah.
There were six nemesis cakes made with six different types of chocolate.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to sort of taste each one, and it wasn't even. That
was there
radical,
a difference?
You had to be like pretend you were a really, really, really good chef and say,
okay.
Oh, I can really tell the difference between this chocolate and not, you know, which we all were, but we could tell some differences.
Yeah.
You could taste it was a bit
yeah.
chalky or it was a bit, well, some of them were too perfumed.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we used to use a chocolate that we changed.
Yeah, Amadeus.
People's tastes change, I think, and people like maybe as people know more about chocolate, I think they. Might not like such sweet chocolate as maybe 20 years ago.
I think that's what's happening. I think I sense that just because what's on offer on the chocolate shelves
yeah.
in the shops is a lot of higher percentage chocolate bars.
Yeah.
75, 80, 85, 90,
yeah.
99.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think that we've had chefs that we just couldn't teach to make a nemesis?
Have you?
Do you think everybody can make one?
I think it's part of your sort of badges of honour that you need to be able to make a nemesis.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, though, that I genuinely think eludes the average person. Like, have you ever made one?
No, I've made
That's
the chocolate hazelnut cake, which
yeah.
is in the
yeah.
easy
and also,
two, I think.
Because it has only got four ingredients, you really need to make sure that those ingredients are the best quality.
Chocolate, butter, sugar, eggs.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, we use buffalo milk butter, which is also, like...
High fat.
Yeah, and
intense,
it's thick. White... butter and really neutral and clean. We use fine chocolate, sugar, and then really beautiful eggs as well.
Good eggs.
That's it. Yeah.
Great.
When people listening to you, they're going to rush off and do it.
Go and make it.
You can watch
it on
YouTube.
The challenge of it is
yeah,
difficult.
Sean made one on YouTube, didn't you? Did you make
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, there we go.
That's
My
the incentive, taste. Is the challenge.
Yeah. But people do phone the restaurant if they're having trouble with it. I'm not encouraging people to do so, but
we'll give them your mobile number.
My email.
800,000 listeners for listening to this now.
People are phoning up.
Yeah.
I remember people calling up and saying, we ruined their dinner party. I had a few of those. But not with Nemesis. It was a woman called me up and she made this lemon sorbet. The lemon ice cream. And she said, you know, it didn't work and you ruined my dinner party. And I said, well, I just gave the chef the recipe and he just made one. And it's perfectly fine. So
take that. Other thing is you've got to make sure you volumize the egg extremely,
that's really
important. Probably at 5 times the volume. And then once you've mixed the chocolate into the egg mixture, the other thing we do is we hit the tin really hard. It's a good way to bash out the air. Otherwise,
when you pour the mixture into the tin,
mm,
bash it hard.
Then you just drop it or hit it really hard on the work surface, and then all those air bubbles that you've got in there from just whipping it kind of drop out, and it gives it that intense texture that's quite unique. And that's maybe why people can't make it. And when you cook it, if it gets a crunchy topping, wrong.
Yeah, you don't want that crispy top.
No, it has to have like a just set top. I mean. Okay. The finer details.
We could have put this in the book, but of course, it never occurred to us. But there also, I think the cloth in the tin is a big difference. I don't think we had that in the first book, is putting the cloth when you put the bain marie, the water in the big tin, and then you put that cloth down. Mm. I think that's a good thing to do.
Okay, I'll go back.
All right, we'll come back. We're going to have dinner tonight, so we'll come back and have a piece of Nemesis for dessert.
Catch you later.
Yeah,
see you later.
Thanks.
That was great. It's good. It's really good.
And Nemesis Workshop, we could do a phone in.
Okay,
yeah.
Call us with your problems. Okay. When you were growing up, what was it like cooking and eating in the Fiennes family? What was that like?
Sometimes quite stressful, because there was 8 of us, 6 children and 2 parents, and then we had, for many years, we also had a foster brother, Mick, so it would have been 9 people. But generally, it was 8 of us. But I have as you asked me that, Ruthie, I have a very strong memory of family meals, especially Sunday or Saturday. And I have memories, too, of my parents sometimes giving a small dinner party, very simple, often something like spaghetti bolognese. Mm. And then I remember we all were tantalised when these grown-ups came. So this one, I'd be about 8 or 9, and these friends came, and you get the whole sense of this adult world where people have come and the women have put on some earring or lipstick, and the men have brushed their hair and thrown a tie on or something, or not. Yeah. Or, you know. And I remember being tantalised by the adult world, and we had this game, the eldest 4 of us, called Spy on the Grown-Ups, which we actually technically had gone to bed. Yeah. But we used to love tiptoeing down the stairs, opening the door and sort of listening. And we'd hear a snippet of conversation, which we probably misheard. And we'd run up the stairs and report the bit of conversation
back
that we had heard.
I think I did the same. I remember sitting on the stairs and, sometimes we now sort of complain about dinner parties or going to those kind of dinner parties or going to a dinner party. But for a child, it is it's so intriguing, isn't it? The adult, as you say, the adult world of manners and food and a different kind. But would your mother cook very differently, do you think, for the dinner party as she would cook for 9, 8 children? Was it a very different...
Well, there was a time when we were finally... Yes, she would. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when that was... I think she developed a reluctance just because I think she felt pressure to be a good cook, and she thought that thing about, I'm going to disappoint. So I think it was... Yeah. And for a time my parents were very pushed financially. We were in Ireland in the early 1970s, and there was a whole summer where the lunch was only ever mashed potatoes and gnaw packet soup.
Mm. Packet soup.
Yeah. And we all got very good at making gnaw packet soup and mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
And in the evening, maybe it would be a macaroni cheese or shepherd's pie or something.
But you felt satisfied by that, did you?
Yeah, never felt,
never felt
hungry, no.
Yeah.
But my parents love food. I mean, but when you talk about loving food, people often think you're an indulgee, but I think it needn't be the case. You can just, it just can be a really good piece of cheese and a cracker and fresh tomato,
exactly,
and that can be pleasurable.
Best, yeah, the memory.
Yeah.
people ask me, why did I learn to cook or why did I become so interested in cooking? And I think that at a certain point in your life, if you like to eat,
yeah,
and you can't really afford
it's connected
to go out,
to eating, yeah.
You know, you want to eat well, so you have yeah. to kind of cook well. Yeah, and I think that is something that...
I think that's key. If you love eating, if you love to
eat... If you want to eat, yeah.
You really want to cook, yeah.
But I, so again, sort of going from the nemesis, that you chose a nemesis, because I also, you and I have such a close relationship and connection to Italy. I've had phone calls from you from the market saying, Ruthie, I've just seen the most incredible leaves of cicoria, yeah. or I've seen mushroom, girole. How am I going to cook this fungi or whatever it was that you saw? Because you do go to, you have this house yeah. in Umbria, not yeah. far from mine. Yeah. And I've had calls from you from the market. I've had calls from you while you're cooking. And I've had calls from you after you've cooked something and said, let me tell you about what I just cooked last night with you, because it was really good. And you might learn something if I tell you this. What was it like in Umbria? Because you've been to me in Tuscany, but I haven't been to your house. So just what's it like food-wise? Do you have a big kitchen?
I have a simple kitchen, a simple stove, but fine, you know, four hobs and an oven. But the big table and... Actually, I have a memory of going to, when you gone to the house that you take in Italy, you have lots of veg and fruit and stuff ripening already, waiting to be consumed. And I definitely echo that with a table with bowls full of fruit. And if it's very hot, I can't keep veg out, but tomatoes I will keep out. Mm. But if when it gets very hot, the fridge is a resource, because... But no, I mean, there's a market in the local town, and I go to the market. There is the Italian co-op, I have to say, is great.
Not bad.
Really great.
We'll hear it for the Italian co-op.
Yeah, we'll, no. And, I agree. And there are others. There was a small butcher's, which I always go to, so I love...
Is there a restaurant there that you go to?
There is, yes, but it's just outside. Nonna Gelsa, it's a trattoria.
Yeah.
Which is a great, simple, really good Umbrian cooking.
Yeah. I think Umbrian cooking, it's so interesting about Italy. I would say that food varies from region to region, but also from city to city, and also from town to town. So I think that even though you're quite close to me, there are probably more Umbrian food. Do you have a lot of lentils there and beans? Or
lentil soup.
Yeah,
and chickpea soup.
Yeah. And what about when you're are you alone there? Do you cook? Do you cook in a different way when you're solitary?
Well, I'm usually when I'm there, I'm mostly there on my own, I have friends who come visit and I cook, but I do more. I'm more engaged with shopping and cooking when I'm in Italy than I am.
Because
I got the time to go out and properly select food and think about what I'm going to eat. And I love going to the market. It's great for people watching.
And it tells you a lot about the culture, doesn't it? Yeah. It tells you about the people who are selling the food there, what they're eating, what the, you know, the way they shop, the market is a kind of...
And the enthusiasm of the people selling the food, and they, you know, the lady saying the cheese, will cut you a piece of cheese. And the kind of... And also you feel their delight with their food.
Yeah, culture.
You feel their kind of excitement about what they're selling.
Yeah. It is very, very regional. And I think also when you come, when we're in Tuscany together, we just sit there, don't we, for hours, you know, talking and eating some more. And it's all kind of one big table and one conversation. The River Cafe is excited to announce the return of our Italian Christmas gift boxes. Our alternative to the traditional hamper, they bring you all of our favorites from the River Cafe kitchen, the vineyards, and the designers from all over Italy. They're available to pre-order now on shoptherivercafe.co.uk. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With summer fast approaching, life tends to get busy. Seeing family, friends, hosting dinners, barbecues, picnics in the park, and everything else that comes between. What's also important is that we find time for ourselves to rest and recharge. Therapy can be a vital tool to assist you with boundaries and managing your schedule in a way that helps you stay happy and healthy. If you're looking to find a new therapist or start therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is worth a try.
It's entirely online, which makes it easy, accessible, and flexible with your schedule. Completing a short questionnaire will match you to the right licensed therapist for you. If it's not working, you can change for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Tell me about eating and acting. What's the deal there? Do you eat?
Well, that's a good question. I think you need a bit of food for energy. So to have starved yourself or not have eaten within 3 hours before a performance, I think your sugar level would drop. I mean, but I know I can't eat a big meal.
What do you eat?
Not big.
And what about on a film set? We talked
breakfast,
to
breakfast.
Oh, really?
They have now found ways to shorten the day, and they have what they call a running lunch. A lot of films won't. You can maybe grab 20 minutes to have a sandwich, and they'll have a running lunch from 12 to 2. Mm. Maybe if they do stop, it's half an hour only.
And so you were, as I said, you were in Rome.
I was filming in Rome twice this year. I was filming in this film Conclave, which you mentioned about. A film recreating the conclave when the cardinals, when the Pope has died and all the cardinals get into the Sistine Chapel and they are sequestered away from the world, they have no contact with the outside world at all while they vote for the new Pope, and they have to keep voting until the required majority is achieved.
Can one of them say, I want to be Pope, and campaign to be Pope?
There's a bit of that in it. It's based on a great book by Robert Harris.
Yeah.
And it was written maybe 9 years ago. And it's been directed by Edward Berger, who directed All Quiet on the Western Front, which got a lot of acclaim the last season. He was a wonderful director. Very, very, very good. Very lovely man. Very detailed and very... in the best sense, attentive to the actors and the nuances that he wants them to bring out. I love working with him and the wonderful Stanley Tucci.
Yeah, he loves
playing my. We're two cardinals who are friends, and we hit a few bumpy patches in our friendship in the film. But
do you both want to put yourselves up for being Pope?
In different ways. Mm. He's a bit more. We're both reluctant to admit it that we do, and he's brilliant in the film, I have to say.
Did the Vatican? Were they involved?
They just rise above it. They're not really involved, but nor they just...
And they let you film in the Vatican?
No. There is a whole... The key voting scenes are in the Sistine Chapel in real life. Yeah. And there exists a Sistine Chapel set made, I believe, for the mini-series The Young Pope, which I think starred Jude Law.
Yeah, that was Jude Law.
Yeah, Jude. Yeah. That set of the Sistine Chapel was mothballed, and then our production brought it out, cleaned it up, repainted it, and it's the whole of the first 20 feet of the Sistine Chapel with the Day of Judgment at one end is a copy. Yeah. And they add the rest with CGI. But I've seen bits of the footage with the added CGI, and it looks like we're in the real place. Wow.
And then for me, what I'd also like to know is, where did you eat in Rome?
Don't ask me the names, Ruthie.
No,
I've gone...
Okay, just tell me about the food. How did it feel to be eating the food of Rome for as long as you were there?
Stanley, I hope you don't mind me bringing you up again in this podcast with Ruthie, but Stanley Tucci brought... a chunk of us towards the end, a group of us who were filming, including Edward, to this wonderful restaurant called, not Pomodori, but Pomidori, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's an old family restaurant that was beloved of Pasolini, the director. And he organised this wonderful meal there late, very late after a day's filming. And that, I think, was the best meal I had. They had put on a special meal because it was Stanley. And they were charming, and I went back there to that restaurant again when I returned to Rome later this year in the summer to make the return. And it's just very, and you don't really, they kind of give you food, you don't really order. I mean, you can order, but they just sort of present you with what they feel is the best pasta of the evening. And it was very easy, and I definitely preferred the more trattoria style than the restaurants, the high-flying restaurants I'm not drawn to so much.
Did you eat out a lot? After filming?
On Conclave, I ate out quite a bit, but the filming hours are so long. In the end, I would go back to my flat and I'd cook something. But in the weekends, we'd eat out,
And what about in Greece?
In Greece, on Corfu, we were in Corfu for most of it, and we came across a wonderful restaurant which served the most exquisite lamb that was on a spit. Oh, my God, the lamb was just extraordinary, just so succulent and tasty. And Spiros' restaurant it was. It was quite a simple restaurant catering for mostly tourists, but, God, the lamb was...
Wow. What month was that? Would that have been spring lamb?
May.
Yeah.
May in Corfu.
Oh, you were in Morocco. Is that also...
Tagine.
Don't you think?
Tagine, baby.
Yeah, I agree. I think Moroccan food is...
Oh, no, it's Moroccan. No, that was... heaven. Heaven. The tagine cooking is one of the best ways of cooking I think I've come across.
Yeah, when the lamb kind of serves soft.
That was...
good. I was going to ask you about the menu.
Because,
here we are, chef. I'm a chef. Yeah. Sean's a chef. We're going into a restaurant. And I remember you calling me up from there and saying that you were, learning the skills. A woman from San Francisco came, didn't she, a chef?
Dominique Crène, who I think has a restaurant in San Francisco called Atelier Crène. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful chef's table on her. Mm. She's from Brittany originally. She's fantastic. And she came and she designed all the food for the film. And then she oversaw the initial first few days of shooting. Then she left... a couple of her chefs with us who oversaw not just the food and the preparation of the food, but they were looking at the kitchen staff in our film to make sure that they behaved in their demeanour and their rhythm of movement, so anyone looking at it would believe it was a working kitchen.
What was it like playing a
chef? Did you believe
it
was a working kitchen?
I thought I believed it was a working kitchen. No, yeah. I did. Good. I definitely did. I mean, you were just such a fantastic character at that. And that type of food and the hidden humor. I was saying to Willem that Richard and I went to El Bulli in the early days, that restaurant in Spain, and it was very much one little tiny piece of food after another, one olive that exploded in your mouth and one, piece of crab that, you had to pick, and then that was it. And they said to us, after 12 courses, he said, now we're going to finish with ravioli with parmesan and butter and sage. And I thought, at last, we're getting something to eat. And a plate came, and it was just a plate. And so we just waited and waited and waited. And we said, where is the ravioli? And they said that basically it was a spray. It was a spray that they'd sprayed on the plate, and it had the essence of ravioli with butter and parmesan. And we had to take our finger and kind of wipe the plate. And that was the dish, and I thought, that's okay.
That's exactly, the menu is inspired by exactly that.
Yeah, that kind. Yeah. So what was it like being a chef in that situation?
Well, as you saw from the film, I run the restaurant, he doesn't do much cooking at all. He's overseeing it until the very end when he's challenged to make a good old-fashioned cheeseburger, which he does make.
Yeah.
And I had to cook that.
Did you learn skills? Just
the cheeseburger.
Just the cheeseburger.
Yeah, yeah.
But you make a good cheeseburger?
It was good. Yeah.
Is there something that you love about a restaurant or going? I always say that people do very private things in a public space. Have you used restaurants as a sort of safety net, do you think, to do something that's difficult or not?
If you meet someone I usually eat either with one other or on my own or maybe after a show with whoever might have been coming. I love going on my own to restaurants with a book, and it's a privilege, but to have a glass of wine and simple food, I love that. But going with... I have been in situations where this is the meal where you tell so-and-so that you're not going to do the film, or you tell them that you can't see them anymore, or, and that's heavy. That's, I mean, that in that sense, when it's a tricky thing, then the restaurant is a sort of padding, as you say, a safety net.
Yeah.
But
it means you don't enjoy.
Yeah.
It's all then the food and the service, then that's all a kind of pathway to get through the difficult thing you've told yourself you've got to do.
So I like
to be in a relaxed context where it's just the enjoyment of sharing food with people and of course drink a good, you know, let's talk about alcohol.
Let's talk about a drink. Let's have a drink.
I love a martini, I love a Negroni and wine. I mean, not in excess, but I just love that that little drop in the kind of anxiety.
Yeah.
And I hate getting really off my face. I hate the after effects, but I just love that little with the first.
Do you have a cocktail? Do you start
martini,
with a
gin martini?
I love a cocktail. We're saying how cocktails. We had dinner once with some American friends. We say how their parents, you know, some Americans have like bars in their house. Mm-hmm. You know, that was that very American thing, a bar, and having a cocktail. But how delicious a cocktail is, you know, and how nice. And so, it's interesting because when the last thing I saw of yours was Beat the Devil.
Beat the Devil was a monologue written by David Hare, who suffered from contracting COVID very badly. So he wrote about it in the form of a monologue, which I performed at the Bridge Theatre. So it was about 45 minutes of a man's account of having COVID, very severe symptoms. And it was also an account of the government's handling of COVID or lack of handling of COVID when borders remained open and it seemed that no one had a handle on it.
We saw it at the Bridge and then...
But I also did it on the back of one martini.
You did?
River Cafe. sat down next to me and said, what are you doing, Riff? What are you doing? I'm doing this mod. Let me hear it. I can't read it. It's 45 minutes. Doesn't matter. I'll just hear a little bit.
Oh, you said it was so funny because you said, I'll just do the first 5 minutes. And so you did the first 5 minutes and I said, you can't stop. Don't stop. And then I said, don't stop. Because we just did not want this to stop. So it was 45 minutes of my sitting there listening over a dry martini to the monologue. And the next day, a friend of mine said to me on the phone, you know, I was going to come over at the table and say hello to you, but I could just see you couldn't get a word in edgewise. Rafe was talking and talking and talking. And I said, that was the monologue. If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The last thing we could talk about is Macbeth. Tell us what's happening now.
It's a tour of Macbeth. I certainly wanted to, and Simon Godwin, who's directing, we both felt that to do it in unusual spaces, not in the West End, but also take it, not be London-centric for all of the tour. But we said we're in Liverpool from late November, mid-November to just before Christmas. Then we have Christmas break and we go back to Edinburgh for 2 weeks. Then we come to London for 6-7 weeks in February, March. And then we close in Washington, D.C.
Simon Godwin is also running all the artistic. He's the artistic director of the Shakespeare Theatre in Washington. So that's the link.
Where will it be in London?
It'll be in a warehouse in South London, okay. Sort of towards the Rotherhithe area of London. Yeah. We're finding great big warehouses and we're putting in a module of a theatre. And there'll be some sort of sense of walking into a war zone as you take your seat.
To do more theatres in raw space?
I think it's exciting. I like going to different unusual spaces to see a play or any kind of performance.
Yeah. Even the bridge is great.
Yes, you know, I think to go out of the familiar the patterns of the West End.
Red velvet seats and, you know.
Red velvet seats, which are so, with no knee room, so close together. Yeah. But you know, it's still, I've seen fantastic things in the West End. So it's just... I also think I toured in this T.S. Eliot poem, Four Quartets, about 2 years ago, and I hadn't toured much in England, and I love touring. I love going to different cities, and I something maybe it's romantic, but I liked going on the road a bit.
We did First Love. I can't remember when that was.
Samuel
it was about
Beckett's
10
First
years
Love.
Ago, maybe, or more. Yeah. And do you remember that?
I remember getting very nervous because it was out of a theatrical context where somehow the whole sort of physical routine of a theatre, the dressing room, the corridor, the backstage, and the audience, that's all. But this was daylight. Mm. I think it was early summer. Mm. And I remember at one moment just suddenly I have a probably inadvisable habit of slightly running the lines before you go on stage. Mm. And when you're slightly nervous, you can start to go through the first lines. Then you blank. What's that line? Mm. That word. I know that word. And then and then it can build and you have to go rushing back to the script. And it's all nerves. I had a moment like that here because I think it felt quite exposing with that because there were no lights. It was just, I could see everyone's faces.
It's interesting because we did that. We did about four of them. We did it with you and Ian McKellen.
Right.
And then I remember we did one with Judi Dench.
Right.
Do you remember that? And we managed to seat about 80 or 100 people. And I thought, oh, it'll be so nice for the actors to be in a home with people and in a relaxed setting. And literally, we almost couldn't get Judi Dench to come down. She froze. Yeah. It's the same exact. She sat in my bedroom and there was like, Judy's feeling, and she said the same thing as you, that she did not suffer from stage fright, but there's something about the, you know.
Well, it's, when you're on stage in a theatre, you have lights, and the lights are on the performer or on oneself, and they therefore most of the audience are in darkness. You can feel yourself cocooned.
Yeah.
But if you perform in daylight and you see the faces... Yeah. You can, in your neuroses, you can read into their face something like, oh, they're bored, or that. And if they've got a furrowed brow, you immediately assume that person's looking at their furrowed brow. They must be confused or irritated. Mm. Often they're just concentrating.
Mm. I do that in the restaurant. We have an open kitchen.
Yeah.
And you're watching as they put the spoon into their mouth. And so when I go to a restaurant, I have this huge smile. This is absolutely delicious. And
so there is that thing about the theatre of the restaurant, the people greeting you and that.
Yeah.
And years ago, I worked not in a restaurant. I worked in Brown's Hotel as a house porter. So I was literally the lowest of the low with a white coat and I changed light bulbs and I hoovered corridors and I polished brass.
Yeah.
But I got to see that real divide between the machinery of a hotel backstage and the stink of the kitchen or the washing up where all food has been chucked out.
But a lot of actors worked as waiters. And I thought, well, that's probably because it's a theatrical setting, it's drama. And also, I often say to them, you know, no matter what mood you're in, no matter what your girlfriend said to you today, or if your boyfriend was, you know, just lost his job, basically you are playing the role. You know, even if you don't, you're playing the role of somebody who really likes people, who's really happy to see people, and hopefully you don't have to play that role because you feel it.
But
if you don't feel it, too bad.
And it is key. When someone smiles at you and you feel that your custom is valued and that the choice, they want to help you, it is a huge difference between the slightly switched off look or
that you're not good enough. Well, you are deeply loved in the restaurant.
You're
You have a house now, a beautiful house in Suffolk, which I have, still haven't seen, but I'm going to come and we're going to cook together. And so tell me about what it's like cooking there.
I like to cook very simple food, right? I mean, this sounds... anyway, I have your cookbooks to hand, and Otto Lengi. And I like his recipes a lot.
I do too.
And I love his slow-cooked lamb, which is the last thing I cooked. You marinate it for 2 days.
What do?
You marinate it for two days.
A leg of lamb?
Yeah, shoulder.
Shoulder.
Yeah. And then you soak it in all these garlic and lemon and spices, and you wrap it up in cling film and let it in the to keep it in the fridge for as long as possible, and then slow cook it for about 5 hours.
It just falls away from the bake.
Food is so much, but it's also, you know, it's about love and it's about relaxing. It's about being with others, being by yourself, thinking about your family. And I guess it's really about comfort. And so my last question to you is, do you have a comfort food?
I don't eat a lot of pasta, but I love pasta, and that would be a comfort food.
Very comfort food.
Yeah. 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 I just think, I don't know what it is.
It is.
It's not...
I agree.
A breakfast is my favourite meal.
Oh. Your favourite meal?
Mm. I love breakfast. Mm. No, I love an evening meal, but there's something about breakfast which I just... It's about starting the day. It's about...
What do you have, Ray?
I will have some yogurt with walnuts and a bit of honey. And then I'll have an egg or two with some toast or a piece of smoked salmon.
Mm.
Yeah. And a coffee.
We have to go to Mexico together because in Mexico, breakfast is the meal.
Yeah.
So good. It's so good.
Love you lots. And
thank you,
Ray. It was great to talk to you, Ruthie.
Thank you.
Okay, we're done. Yeah? All right, let's go eat.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willa Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. This episode had additional contributions by Sean Wynne Owen. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world. People who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.